Hello and welcome to Sound Body, a weekly program of information on health topics and ideas that can help you live life to its fullest. I'm Louise Craig. Every now and again, I run across articles about the ways our behaviors can impact our health and others. They seem to boil down to the idea that when we are kind to ourselves and others, we tend to be healthier and promote health in other people. Since it's not always easy to be our best, nicest, kindest selves, today we're going to read about people doing the right thing, ideas about how to help others, and the toll rudeness takes on the medical care you receive. So, a mishmash of things from a variety of sources that I hope will spark some kindness for you today. And we'll start with something from the February 2017 RealSimple.com, and this is titled, Relating 5 Things to Say When You Have No Words. Number 1, written by Noah Galloway, a veteran and motivational speaker, say nothing at all. A good friend of mine recently lost his mother. Everybody was reaching out to him concerned. I texted him, if you just want to hang out and not talk, I'm here. He took me up on it. He came over, and we ended up talking about college, football, life, our kids, everything but his loss. At times, we just sat there and didn't say a word. Guys have that ability. Guys could learn from women about opening up and sharing feelings, but there's a happy medium. Sometimes we need a moment that feels normal and reminds us that there are still things in life that have always made us happy, like time with friends. That from Noah Galloway. Noah lost 2 limbs as a soldier in the U.S. Army. He is the author of Living with No Excuses, The Remarkable Rebirth of an American Soldier. He lives in Alabaster, Alabama. Number 2 comes from Robert Zucker, grief counselor. Fall back on a heartfelt cliche. So many of my grieving clients say people avoid them or don't step up the way they expected. It's common to become frozen, paralyzed with fear, worried you will say the wrong thing. Don't be afraid of speaking in cliches. People aren't counting on you to provide the brilliant gem that will fix things. Your presence and your caring are what they appreciate. You can just say, I'm so sorry, or I'm thinking of you. Early in my career, I was working in a hospital, and I remember going to my first funeral for a child. I just looked into the eyes of the parents and said, I'm so sorry, as we all teared up. I was with them, expressing my sorrow. I wasn't presuming to have their sorrow. I had my own sorrow. To me, that's the essence of what this is about, being present, witnessing, caring, and not running away from people when they're hurting. Robert Zucker is the author of The Journey Through Grief and Loss. He lives in Holyoke, Massachusetts. Number 3 comes from Lori Rudiman, a human resources specialist. Acknowledge specific pain. I used to work in human resources at a large corporation. My primary job was to lay people off. During that time, my husband was laid off. One thing that really struck me from seeing both sides was the shame people felt even when they were let go solely because of the company's financial situation. While we should be wary of playing counselor or psychologist, I think it's good to acknowledge that your loved one might feel embarrassed if he's lost a job and to remind him that he has nothing to be ashamed of. By attacking the shame head on, you can take away its power and prevent it from lurking over everything. Lori Rudiman is an HR consultant in Raleigh, North Carolina. Number 4 comes from Don Schumacher, a psychologist. Open the door to conversation. One of the big fears people have when they lose someone is that some way or another their loved one will be forgotten, that if they don't keep the conversation going, the person will disappear. Give people the option to continue talking. I would ask about the person's treatment. They usually get right to the point. I was so worried about him being uncomfortable. And as time passes, it's good to keep the dialogue going. What I usually do is wait 2 or 3 weeks, then get back in touch. I ask, How has it been going? If you want to talk, just let me know. And that comes from Don Schumacher, president and CEO of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. He lives in Alexandria, Virginia. Lastly, we have number 5 from Glennon Doyle Melton, an author. Say or text, dinner is on your doorstep. I'm a raging introvert, so when I'm in pain, the last thing I want is to sit there and chat. When my marriage fell apart, my best friend texted me and said, there's Chipotle and a milkshake on your doorstep. I was like, hell yes. I didn't have to see her. I didn't have to take a shower. All I had to do was open the door and stuff my face with her love. Another friend came over and did my laundry and didn't make me talk to her. These were lovely gestures because my friends weren't trying to make themselves feel better by seeing me. They were completely and totally unselfish. They took a minute to think, what would actually make Glennon feel most loved? They didn't do it their way. They did it my way. It was a one-sided love offering. Glennon Doyle Melton is the author of Love Warrior and the founder of Mamastry.com and Together Rising. She lives in Naples, Florida. We turn now to the New York Times, written by Perry Class, MD, and published on April 10th, 2017, titled, Rude Doctors, Rude Nurses, Rude Patients. Just how much rudeness is there in the hospital and who bears the brunt of it? A few weeks ago, I wrote about a study that looked at what happens to medical teams when parents are rude to doctors. In these studies of simulated patient emergencies, doctors and nurses working in the neonatal intensive care unit were less effective in teamwork and communication and in their diagnostic and technical skills after an actor playing a parent made a rude remark about the quality of the hospital. These results bothered me, not because I was surprised that there might be rudeness and worse coming from parents, but because I pride myself on a kind of professional immunity. Sure, parents are sometimes rude and occasionally openly hostile, and sure, I acknowledge that that can be upsetting, but I wouldn't have imagined that it would actually affect my medical skills or decision-making. If those supremely highly trained NICU personnel are actually worse at resuscitating newborns or diagnosing life-threatening complications after exposure to rudeness, though, what happens to the rest of us as we go through the lower stakes but still important interactions of our clinical days? Many of the readers who responded to that column seemed to think that the doctors and nurses were somehow doing it on purpose, responding punitively to the simulated rude parent. But in fact, they were performing at a lower level on observed and graded tests of their medical abilities. Other readers pointed out that it's always good policy to be polite to the people taking care of you, and many others just wanted to register that the medical environment is full of rudeness on all sides. Patients complain about egregious rudeness by doctors, nurses, ward clerks, and receptionists, while nurses tell stories of harsh patients and family members, not to mention rude doctors. None of that is a surprise, and in fact, there is a good deal of literature to suggest that the medical environment includes all kinds of harshness, and that much of the rudeness you encounter as a doctor or nurse is likely to come from colleagues and coworkers. An often-cited British study from 2015 called Sticks and Stones reported that rude, dismissive, and aggressive communication between doctors, inevitably abbreviated in a medical journal as RDA communication, affected 31% of doctors several times a week or more. The researchers found that rudeness was more common from certain medical specialties, radiology, general surgery, neurosurgery, and cardiology. They also established that higher status was somewhat protective. Junior doctors and trainees encountered more rudeness. In the United States, a number of studies have looked at how rudeness affects medical students and medical residents as part of tracking the different ways in which they are often mistreated. One article earlier this year in the journal Medical Teacher charted the effect on medical student morale of a variety of experiences, including verbal and nonverbal mistreatment by everyone from attending physicians to residents to nurses. Mistreatment of medical students, the authors argued, may actually reflect serious problems on the part of their teachers, such as burnout, depression, or substance abuse. It's not enough to classify the perpetrators, that is, the rude people, as unprofessional and tell them to stop. Similarly, in the British study, when the researchers asked about why rudeness happens, they identified five themes: workload, lack of support, patient safety, hierarchy, and culture. It may not be obvious that all of these can be specifically addressed, but it's important to recognize the different ways that they can play into harsh and disrespectful language in a hospital. As a senior doctor, to be rude to a medical student or a resident is to fall short of being the teacher you hope to be. To be rude to a patient or a family member is probably to fail as the physician and human being you thought you were. And from the point of view of that patient or that family member, the medical hierarchy is often somewhat opaque. If someone has been rude to you, you may not know whether this is the clumsiness of a nervous trainee or the arrogance of a senior doctor with God delusions. Sometimes rudeness comes from pressure, and heaven knows there is plenty of pressure in medical settings. In the Sticks and Stones article, the only context in which there was some justification for rudeness was when patient safety was at stake and someone spoke sharply to demand immediate action or to reprimand someone for a mistake. And of course, when you know you've made a mistake or put someone at risk, you may become that much more sensitive. Many years ago, I made an intern cry on morning rounds by asking more than once why he hadn't checked a certain blood test. He clearly experienced it as a public shaming, with a strong suggestion that he had risked the patient's life. Was my manner a little thoughtless? Probably, and maybe even a little righteous. The intern's well-being was not my priority. But it's hard to see that the public shaming helped the patient or the doctor. Sometimes rudeness is a matter of perception. When my mother was in the hospital 3 years ago, I felt irritated when one of the rounding doctors kept looking down at her phone, even though she probably was using the phone to act on every one of the decisions being discussed, changing drug doses, ordering labs, requesting consultations, or at least making notes to herself to do those things. It was a generational problem, I told myself. If she'd been scribbling on a clipboard, I wouldn't have minded. In almost any setting, rudeness does tend to beget rudeness, whether because the top people in a hierarchy are modeling it for those they should be teaching, or because it engenders anger, stress, and a desire to strike back. It's not enough to say rudeness is unprofessional, so therefore, don't be rude. And it's not enough to say being affected by rudeness would be unprofessional, so therefore I'm not affected. Rudeness affects your spirit, your morale, your connection to your job, and your effectiveness in that job. It gets in the way of health, and it gets in the way of healing. And now we come to Oprah Magazine of October 2016, and we look at the world of mental and behavioral health. This is titled Work in Progress and written by Katie Arnold Ratliff. Deep in the pasture land of western Massachusetts, off a road cluttered with clapboard houses, sprawls a 700-acre plot known as Gould Farm. Its dairy cows, the ladies everyone calls them, live at the top of Gould Road, which ambles past the farm's red barn, its row of tractors, its domed greenhouse carpeted with tender lettuce. The farm is run by a handful of teams. The gardeners till and harvest vegetables, which the cooks sauté and steam for dinner. Dessert comes from the barn, a bakery in disguise, where a squad in white toques measures and mixes. Their milk comes from the aforementioned ladies, tended by another team, who also sees to the cow's progeny, such as Pudding, newly born to Phoebe. The pasture abuts the vast woods encircling the farm, where the grounds crew clears fallen trees and lets goats graze the trails clean. Everyone has a job, Every task is essential. But nothing is more essential than the work of healing. Every person here has come because out in the world, mental illness had finally ground his or her life to a halt. At the turn of the 20th century, people who were mentally ill, or believed to be, were often housed in asylums where beds were scarce and windows were barred. In her famous 1887 exposé of a New York women's asylum, undercover journalist Nellie Bly saw patients beaten, berated, served rotten food, and left to suffer in the cold. Psychiatric practices of the day included crude electrotherapy, freezing baths, and physical restraint. So it's hard to overstate just how extraordinary it was that in 1913, devout Christians Will and Agnes Gould purchased a tract of farmland to found a restorative community for the mentally ill, a place where daily toil and friendly fellowship would be cornerstones of treatment. A century later, these principles, minus the religious bent, endure at the farm, supplemented with modern medicine and therapy. The few dozen guests, as residents are called, pay on a sliding scale and stay as long as they need. When a guest arrives, often after a hospital stay or several, he or she is given a job. Work, the farm's leaders believe, is therapy. "What's the first thing that disappears when you lose your grip on life?" asks a former guest. "Your sense of purpose," which is just what a job restores. This morning, Main House, the ancient white three-story structure where Gould farmers eat, socialize, and report for duty, is alive with voices and the screech of forks on plates. Guests and staffers who live in houses on the farm are finishing breakfast. The meal is capped with a hesitant but sincere group rendition of Amazing Grace. Guests line up for meds, then join their teams. Today, the bakers, led by staffer Nathan, who whistles Madonna's Borderline while zipping about the kitchen, are making chocolate chip bagels, zest-flecked madeleines, and a sturdy coffee cake. Two women work at stand mixers, diligently bageling. Pans clatter as they're slotted into racks. A scruffy young man measures out madeleine ingredients. Nearby, a younger man leans over a hip-high metal table reading a recipe. After a half hour, vanilla and milk mingle with a mound of sugar in the bowl before him, but adding the eggs is proving difficult. One hit the floor with a sharp crinkle. One went half into the bowl, half down its side. Another broke on the table, albumen slinking across the steel. Now, Nathan walks over with a rag. "Let's tidy up," he says gently. New eggs are retrieved, the man keeps on, the batter materializes. "You never forget that this place exists to help people," Nathan will later say. "But you also got to get the muffins out on time, you know?" The first team a guest joins is the forestry and grounds crew. Tall brambles, acres to clear. After this, other jobs are there for the trying. You might plant, cook, or help the mechanic fix tractors. Where you land is a matter of temperament. "Guests take a crack at things to see what works," says Lizanne Finston, Gould Farm's stalwart, sunny executive director. "We had one guy, a corporate lawyer. He'd never met a pig in his life, but the pig farm became his baby. He researched what makes pigs happy. Turns out one thing is puzzles. So he made a pen of buried objects for them to dig up." Finston opens a fridge full of waxy golden discs. Out rolls a wave of funk. "Two guests are learning cheesemaking," she says. Each Wednesday is community meeting. It's warm out today, so the proceedings are moved to a circle of benches near Main House. Finston, outfitted with Tevas and her ubiquitous coffee cup, brushes a hand through her graying hair and updates the group. So-and-so is leaving. So-and-so is arriving. Friday dinner will be pizza at the barn. The next van to town, Great Barrington, population 6,933, will be Saturday. It's dusk, the sky rosy. Snacks of yogurt and granola have been served. While many guests suffer from intractable illnesses, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, catastrophic depression, the tone is convivial. It's difficult to tell guests from staff. Difficult, but not impossible. A middle-aged woman, her blonde hair limp, finishes her yogurt and, stone-faced, lets the bowl and spoon clatter to the grass. A moment later, she titters, and titters again. Beneath a tree, a bespectacled 20-something girl plucks blades of grass, never looking up. One broad-shouldered, unshaven man sits atop a picnic table, mouth ajar. He seems, as some guests do, to be elsewhere, like a link to life has broken, stranding him. But then he speaks, and it's as though he's woken from a trance. "We're showing Braveheart in our dorm. We'll have face paint. Wear kilts." The so-and-so leaving tomorrow frowns intensely at his feet. He's gawkily handsome. When someone congratulates him, he laughs in tiny bursts and ducks his head. The following afternoon, a small group hikes Diane's Trail, named for the late wife of one of Gould Farm's veteran staffers. The goats tear at leaves, skittering into guests' knees. Among the hikers is a man who just returned to the farm. Some people leave and never come back. Some need two stays, three. Some depart and meet the saddest, most dreaded fate. Last year, when a man took his own life shortly after leaving, Funston broke the news to the guests who'd known him. Couldn't hearing this have set back their progress? "Recovery isn't linear," she says. "You go up, you go back down. We're honest about that." On the trail, the just-returned man speaks in a slurred stream. Talk of his parents morphs into the tale of a long-ago slight perpetrated by his brother. There is no thread to follow. "I see," says the staffer. "That must have been tough." The group walks on, footfalls and hoofbeats muffled by the trail's moss. At dinner on Thursday, the damp heat is persistent. The kitchen serves chicken pot pie, peas, a watermelon feta salad. At the picnic tables, Gould farmers talk, dig into second helpings. A therapist's child climbs a sapling and hangs from her knees. The young man about to leave the farm eats with friends, bent over his plate. Opposite him sits the girl who spent Wednesday's meeting plucking grass. Her face is blank. They all eat in silence. Then the soon-to-be-gone boy turns to the girl. "I'm going to miss you," he says, nodding. "It's been awesome getting to be friends." She smiles in response, her eyes softening, her face radiant. Tomorrow that young man will travel down the hill past the cows, barn, greenhouse, and woods. To leave Gould Farm via Gould Road, you must pass through a 100-yard stretch of foliage, where the road narrows and the trees form a tunnel of pine. Branches block the sky. It's dark in there, even in daylight. Because the road bends, it's difficult to discern where you're going. But then you reach the pavement. The world mercifully widens, and the way forward opens once again. And also, from the Oprah magazine, they have a list of things you can rely on if you're feeling it. Someone else is too. And here's how to find your kind and the comfort they can provide. "I am struggling with anxiety." Create your own profile at Anxiety Social Net, anxietysocialnet.com, to connect with people dealing with everything from social anxiety to agoraphobia. Prefer to meet in person? Find a state-by-state list of support groups at the Anxiety and Depression Association of America's website, ADAA.org. Struggling with depression or bipolar disorder? Locate an in-person or online group at the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance site, DBSAlliance.org. Struggling with postpartum depression? The Postpartum Progress site, postpartumprogress.com, lists support groups in nearly every state as well as in Canada and maintains an online forum. Struggling with schizophrenia? The Schizophrenia and Related Disorders Alliance of America facilitates groups nationwide. Find one on its site, sardaa.org. You can also dial into its phone groups, 855-640-8271, at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, Sunday, Thursday, and Friday, with the passcode 882-86491 number sign. Plagued by obsessive compulsive thoughts and behavior. More than 200 groups are listed with the International OCD Foundation, IOCDF.org, which aids those affected by the disorder and their families. If you are the adult child of an alcoholic, the Adult Children of Alcoholics World Service Organization maintains numerous support groups and hosts call-in and online sessions. meetings.adultchildren.org. Grieving someone who died by suicide. Join one of the many groups for survivors listed on the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention website, afsp.org. If you are a survivor of rape, sexual assault, or incest, After Silence, AfterSilence.org is a message board and chat room for victims of sexual violence. Additionally, Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, ASCASupport.org, organizes support groups around the U.S. and abroad and offers resources for those who want to start their own. If you are battling anorexia, bulimia, binge eating, or food addiction, Eating Disorder Hope catalogs online support groups. eatingdisorderhope.com/recovery/support groups/online. It also offers help and advice for those close to someone struggling to overcome an eating disorder. Self-harming. Daily Strength hosts a web forum where people dealing with self-injury can find encouragement, understanding, and a new way to cope. dailystrength.org/group/self-injury. If you are a veteran who is injured or has PTSD, the VA Combat Call Center, 877-WAR-VETS, or 877-927-8387, is staffed 24/7 by fellow combat veterans or spouses of disabled veterans who can offer immediate help. The Vet Center program site, vetcenter.va.gov, can direct visitors to both group and private counseling sessions in their area. So that is a wide variety, but you know, somehow they all come down to kindness to ourselves and each other. So I hope there was something in there for everyone. Thank you for tuning into Sound Body today. Stay well and come back next week for healthy living ideas. This has been Sound Body, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm Louise Craig, and I hope you'll join me again next week for more health updates and information for healthy living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.